This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Thomas Churchhouse to the show. He is the co-founder, partner, and lead cryptocurrency analyst at Stansberry Churchhouse Research. Thomas, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Good. And you are coming to us from Hong Kong today, is that correct?
Yep, that's right.
Good stuff. Well, you publish a high-end newsletter for cryptocurrency investors or people who are just interested in monetary stuff like this. There's just a ton of interest in this topic right now. What changed? Why did we suddenly have this big run-up in, say, Bitcoin prices, for example? But maybe you want to talk about other cryptos as well. I haven't really tracked them as much. Bitcoin's getting all the headlines, but there's more to the market than just that.
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of factors at play here. One is, and I do liken it to the mid to late 90s and the tech bubble. You know, you've got a tremendous amount of technological promise, you know, heralded by a new technology. But at the same time, you've got a huge amount of money pouring into it. But it's not, the technology isn't really delivering what the money suggests it can for the time being.
So in other words, you're saying the technology valuation side of this equation is overblown. It's in bubble territory, right? The technology is not worth as much as the coins are.
It will be. The problem is that, you know, in the same way that the internet, it was heralded as something that would change everything. And indeed it did. Blockchain is absolutely the same. It will change everything, but it will change everything over time. Thing is, money can move in immediately, whereas those changes do take time, and that's the difference. And that's why you're seeing this, you know, gigantic, and you look, it is a bubble. Let's be quite honest. What we're seeing is a bubble. I don't know whether we're in the fifth inning, the ninth, the eighth, but the kind of price increases we're seeing, especially on some of the other cryptos, and the valuations being placed on them are absolutely inconsistent with what they're going to be able to deliver. So that's something we absolutely have to bear in mind as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this has always been one of my big problems with this, is that people keep talking about the technology, yet they're buying the coins. And the coins are not the technology. They're different things. I mean, the concern I have, and interestingly, you're not super bullish on cryptocurrencies, I think. I mean, that's what you told me off air, so feel free to elaborate on that comment. But they talk about how the dollar is fiat money, how every currency on earth is fiat money, because there's no store of value. It's not tied to anything, right? Like, it's, you know, we're not on a gold standard. But anybody can create another coin tomorrow. Yeah, Bitcoin may have a limited number of coins, but you just have another coin. You know, there's really no limited supply. This is like, it's intellectual property. It comes out of thin air, basically.
The way I would look at it is this. Yes, you can create your own coin, but it doesn't mean anything if you don't have any network effect behind it. If you don't have a degree of confidence and widespread confidence that that coin is going to have any value or retain any value or function as a medium of exchange. And bear in mind that cryptocurrencies is a bit of a misnomer because, you know, yes, there are plenty of coins out there like Bitcoin or Litecoin, for example, that really do function more as we would think of as a currency. You have a huge number of other coins there which aren't currencies per se. They are protocol coins, platform coins. Some of them are decentralized business coins, which are, I guess, a little bit analogous to equity in some respects. So currency is a very, very... it's a misnomer when we're looking at the entire space.
And when it comes to, say, Bitcoin, I would be more bullish on it if I saw people using it as a currency. They're not. Everybody's just using it like the tulip bubble. It's just speculation. I mean, okay, Overstock.com accepts it. I've interviewed Patrick Byrne, the founder and CEO of Overstock, on my show. I've interviewed his current CEO or president, I'm not exactly sure. He's also been on the show, and we've talked about this stuff. And, you know, I love the libertarian thinking and so forth, but it's just not widely used. I heard maybe Expedia accepts it now. I haven't even checked that, but no one's really using it as a currency in any real way.
You're exactly right. And this is one of my biggest concerns about Bitcoin. So, you know, I own Bitcoin. I've had my readers own Bitcoin. They've done very, very well. And just to preface that, just, you know, before we even get into this, crypto is for the very, very low single digit part of your investable assets. I mean, look, 1-2%, maybe 3%. This is not, you know, I'm reading about people taking out mortgages to buy Bitcoin. I mean,
oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah.
You know, so let's just put that within the framework of keeping vaguely sensible hats on here. My issue with Bitcoin, and you're absolutely right, Bitcoin is having real problems scaling. So do you know what the average transaction fee at the moment for Bitcoin? It's running at over $20, nearly $25.
This is the shocking part. It's billed as being this frictionless, decentralized currency, but it's got tons of friction attached to it. It takes tons of processing power and electricity. You got to move a lot of electrons out around to mine these coins. You got to solve a lot of mathematical equations to mine the coins and to process a transaction. And the more coins in circulation and the more the blockchain grows, the bigger this burden becomes. It literally, I mean, you could call it a house of cards, I think. I don't know. I'm not an expert. You are, but it's going to become just incredibly onerous to process a transaction. Processing a credit card transaction is way easier than this, isn't it?
Yeah. So the way I look at Bitcoin is, will it become a form of global decentralized reserve currency, almost like a global settlement layer? So, you know, we have to separate the difference between what is potentially a store of value and what is potentially a medium of exchange. Right now, Bitcoin does not function as a medium of exchange in traditional consumption and commerce. It doesn't. At those prices and confirmation times, it doesn't. The question is, but then again, neither does gold. So the question is, does Bitcoin attain such a network effect? And given its scarcity and given the fact that there is only one Bitcoin, there are forks, but there is only one Bitcoin. Does it attain this kind of decentralized reserve currency status? And if it does, then it could quite easily go to $2 or $3 trillion market cap, up from, say, $300 billion. If it doesn't, then it's going to end badly. And the reality is, no one can tell you what is going to happen. But the way I look at it is just an asymmetric bet. Am I happy to risk 1% of my portfolio for something that could go up 10 times versus go to zero? That's the way I look at it. But I think you're absolutely right that when we're looking at Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, there are simply way other things that are far, far better. Bitcoin Cash, which is a fork of Bitcoin, is fantastic as a medium of exchange. It really does work as cash. Bitcoin itself does not work as a medium of exchange.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So what does, is there a better, like, what's your favorite cryptocurrency? Well, first of all, how big is this market? How many coins are out there nowadays? I mean, I guess Kanye West doesn't have a coin anymore. He did. you know, it's like anybody can create a coin out of thin air. I'm thinking we need a Jason coin.
Well, very easy to do. So there's about 1,500 listed on CoinMarketCap, which is the kind of the go-to website.
Okay, so there's 1,500 coins in existence on.
And there's probably more than that. These are just the ones that are kind of picked up by one of these aggregator sites. Okay. And you've got about a market cap of just over $500 billion, so about 520 billion U.S. dollars, of which 54% of that is Bitcoin.
Okay. Oh, great. This is some really good information. So let's just quantify it again. We got 1,500 coins listed on coincap.com. Is that the website?
CoinMarketCap.com?
CoinMarketCap.com. The 1,500 coins, so 1,500 currencies, if you will. That's the comparison.
Well, currencies, some are you know, what you would call a business almost, and some are kind of protocol or platform coins. So they're
Okay, so I'll ask you about that in just a moment. Let's just finish that because I really want to get the distinction there for the listeners. So then the market value currently of these coins is about $520 billion, so half a trillion. And Bitcoin makes up more than half of that, 54%. So that's a good amount. So what is a platform coin or a business coin that you said behaves like equity versus... Now, what's Bitcoin? First of all, define Bitcoin. Bitcoin's not one of those, right?
No, Bitcoin I call a currency because, you know, look, if I'm transferring Bitcoin from A to B, from me to you, it's done so as a medium of exchange if I can obviously do the transfer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Bitcoin doesn't really offer anything else apart from a just secure, scarce digital asset. It doesn't have any other functionality. So if I own Bitcoin, it just doesn't give me utility in any sense or shape. Now, the platform coins, you know, one of the best ways to think about this is if you look at the internet back in the 1990s and you look at the internet today, Google, Facebook, they are all built off protocols. So, you know, if you think about, you know, just on your web browser right now, you know, it says HTTP, that's Hypertext Transfer Protocol. You've got TCP/IP for internet transfer. You've got SMTP and IMAP for email, so on and so forth. You've got all of these base layer protocols which make up the backbone of the existing internet. Now, you can't buy into those. They are just open protocols. But all the value built on those protocols resides within the enterprise, resides within Google, within Facebook. There is a new layer of protocols being built, a blockchain-based backbone for a, you know, effectively a decentralized web and a new internet. And these protocols you can actually participate in. You can actually buy tokens in these underlying protocols. And probably the biggest and one people are most familiar with is Ethereum. You know, I have a huge number of issues with Ethereum, but, you know, that's a $65 billion platform right now.
Okay, so what does that mean, though? Like, I have a friend that made a bunch of money in Ethereum. So it's a protocol. Well, so when you buy, you still buy a coin versus a stock? Would that be a comparison? Like, if it was a company, you could buy a share of stock versus with Ethereum, you still buy a coin, right?
The way to think about Ethereum is think about a giant decentralized blockchain operating system. So think about like Windows or Mac OS. Yep. Now, if you want to build on top of those, you just build an application on Windows, right? You don't build Windows and then build your application. You build on top of Windows. Ethereum is kind of similar, but it's a global decentralized version of Windows. It's kind of like an operating system. Now, if I own Ethereum, I can actually spend and burn my Ethereum to run my application. I can build my application on Ethereum, distribute it over this global network, as it were. And my Ethereum is used to actually spend, to actually run that application. Ethereum almost is like a little bit like oil in a sense. You can own it, and that's great, and you can own it to speculate on whatnot. But when you're actually operating an application on Ethereum, you need to pay Ethereum to do that.
Okay,
and that's the way Ethereum is
more. So if things go well, how does one make money? And if things go bad, how do they lose money based on what you just said?
Well, as in an Ethereum owner?
Yeah.
So if you own Ethereum, the more and more applications that decide to build on Ethereum will increase the demand for Ethereum. So you need to have some Ethereum to actually execute an application on top of the Ethereum blockchain.
But what kind of application do you put on it? Do you do an ICO and make your own coin? So could I create JSON coin tomorrow and use Ethereum to kind of like manage it?
You absolutely can. And so, you know, the reason and my biggest issue with Ethereum right now is that it's not scaling. So at the moment, Ethereum is a $65 billion platform that cannot support a single enterprise level scalable application. And that is a big issue. I don't know if you saw recently in the past few days, you might have come across something called CryptoKitties. Mm-hmm. CryptoKitties is basically a virtual You remember those Tamagotchi virtual cats that you had to look after? They came on a little device. I mean, this was like a kid's toy.
Not really, but
yeah. Well, this is kind of the equivalent of that. It's a, you know, it's a digital cat game. It's a virtual cat game, and your cat resides on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. It sounds ridiculous, and it is. But the demand for single application basically ground Ethereum to a halt. Now, that to me is problematic. But as an example, that's the kind of application that can be built. Now, obviously, there are far, far better applications that can be built. You know, if you're doing a decentralized logistics supply chain application, for example, and you want to have the ability to be absolutely rigorous and open source and immutable in terms of your supply chain, you can build it on top of Ethereum. You know, that would be one example. But to go back to your original thing, ICOs are by far and away Ethereum's biggest kind of proof of concept use case at the moment.
Okay, so in other words, Ethereum, if you compare it to the gold rush, Ethereum would be selling the Levi's jeans and the picks and shovels to the miners. They're not mining for gold. They're just being Cisco. They're doing the infrastructure play, right?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit, I would say. You know, I don't think Ethereum quite anyone expected the ICO rush, but what, you know, Ethereum for sure has facilitated a lot of it, because they made it a standardized token called an ERC20 token. It's a standardized Ethereum-based token. So you, for example, if you go to ethereum.org, you scroll down the page, you'll see, hey, this is how you launch your own ERC20 token. You create the specs, you create however you want to create your token, and then you can go and launch it. So it's obviously more complicated than that, and you have various economics to your token, but that is how people are, you know, creating a lot of these ICOs. They are simply issuing ERC20 tokens, and that is driving up demand for Ethereum, because if I launch, you know, if you launch JSON coin, well, someone who wants to buy a JSON coin has to buy some Ethereum. So they buy some Ethereum and then they give it to you. So yeah. That's, you know, obviously driven a huge amount of demand for Ethereum as well.
I've heard some criticisms of Ethereum that the technology isn't really that great, that it's hackable and may not have good security. I don't know. You know, everybody's got an opinion about everything. But what do you say to that?
The underlying Ethereum blockchain itself is not hackable. But the problem is that even core developers there, and even one of the main developers there, has said this is experimental tech. So that's the way it's been built, is it's kind of fragile in that perspective. So when you've heard about hackings or vast sums of Ethereum, you know, being locked up or even lost, it's because building on Ethereum is, there's not much room for error. And even one of the co-founders of Ethereum, you know, his company, Parity, have had some major issues with, you know, Ethereum wallets, which have been hackable, had bugs in them. So Ethereum is a little wonky. The way I would look at Ethereum is, you know, Bitcoin is your proof of concept. That was the original proof of concept of, you know, distributed ledger, blockchain value. Ethereum was a 2.0 level of that. But it's, the problem is, it's a bit of a jumbo jet. And right now, the next wave are fighter jets of blockchain platforms. And, you know, those are, you know, ones like, you know, maybe EOS, Cardano, those kind of platforms. So Ethereum, major issues is it doesn't scale. It's expensive to use. So transaction costs, you know, for example, if you try to build Facebook on Ethereum, you know, every time someone hits like, you know, has a like, that's a transaction cost. Right now, those transaction costs run at 50 cents.
Wow, that's super expensive. You could never do micropayments based on Ethereum.
Yeah. No, not even remotely. Yeah. Now, they have plans for scaling, but until we see that happen, at the end of the day, it's a $65 billion platform, as I said, that can't support a single functional enterprise-level decentralized application.
Why would you have to build Facebook on Ethereum? I mean, well, I don't know what Facebook's built on. Well, it's probably PHP or something, or Ruby on Rails. I mean, I have no idea, honestly. But you know, websites are built mostly on WordPress, right? Why do you need Ethereum?
Sure.
Like, where does that come in? I don't even get it.
We're going to get into a bit more deeper stuff here, yeah. But this hasn't really kind of cropped up in the mainstream consciousness yet.
Yeah, tell me about it. Like, people just don't even understand this stuff. I want to ask you, how did you learn all this stuff? Did you just read a million articles? I mean, obviously, there's no degree in cryptocurrencies available yet.
No, it's, you know what? It takes a huge amount of reading, a huge amount of talking to, you know, finding good people who you can trust, and that's very difficult in this space, good people who don't have an agenda, finding them out and talking to them. Very fortunate. I sit on the board of the largest kind of token distribution company who's undergoing the largest token distribution ever seen right now. You would call it an ICO. We don't. That's brought in, over $600 million so far in revenue for its tokens in the past 5 months. That one's going very well. I'm fortunate because I'm fascinated by it. And when you're fascinated by something, it consumes you and you just read, listen, go to conferences.
Totally. I'm the same way, just not on this topic yet, maybe never. I interrupted you and you were answering my question and now I don't remember what we were saying.
So decentralized autonomous organizations. So you'll hear them called DAOs, you'll hear them called decentralized application, DApps. This is why you might want to build a decentralized Facebook on Ethereum. Now, how does that work? If you think of basically all existing companies are centralized. So you have a centralization of ownership. You have typically centralization of points of failure. For example, Google has Google servers. Facebook has their own Facebook servers. If you think of a decentralized autonomous organization, I'm just going to outline what one could look like. So let's say you like online gambling, for example. If you like online gambling, at the moment, what you have to do is you need to go onto a website, find an online gambling website, create an account, log in, send them some money, start gambling. You have absolutely no visibility to anything, really. I mean, if you're playing online blackjack, you've got no idea if you're getting fairly dealt. There's no transparency. There's no visibility. There's nothing. Now, let's say a bunch of guys come together and say, okay, we want to build a decentralized, and I'll make this example even easier, a decentralized global Bitcoin-based lottery. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to issue we're going to create 1 million tokens. The founders are going to retain 10%. We're going to ICO, we're going to create a white paper. We're going to ICO those 900 million tokens. We'll bring in some money. This is what we're going to build. We're going to build a decentralized lottery on Ethereum. So what happens is, you can have a lottery, a standard, lottery, which is completely mathematically verifiable. So anyone can see that every Saturday night at 9 p.m., truly random numbers are being drawn. You can go onto your mobile phone and you can sign up and you can send a Bitcoin or $100 worth of Bitcoin, whatever it is, into a smart contract. That smart contract is completely transparent. It's visible. No one can touch it. And the code just runs. And so the numbers get drawn and the code simply executes the lottery results. Everyone who wins gets paid and the company, say, retains 2%. So the usual lottery payouts are, 50, 60%. This can pay out 90%. 2% are retained and they're distributed to the original token holders, the guys who bought the lottery coin tokens. Basically, you've got a platform being run decentralized, being run by people all over the world. The token holders get some kind of return. Effectively, they get a dividend, a profit share, if you will. So they're all incentivized to obviously support and get people using lottery coin. 2%, say you get 2% of that rake. Say 1% of that goes to the DAO, the decentralized autonomous organization. And what that means is that you build up a pool of funds, and those funds can be dispersed by the community towards people who want to help build the platform. So let's say I put my hand up and I say, hey guys, my name's Tama. I'm a developer. I'd like to create a mobile application. Here's the specs. Here's what I'd like to do. I put forward that to the community. The community votes on it.
How big is the community? You mean like 1 million people or what?
It doesn't actually really matter. So you have token holders, right? So token holders themselves are part of the community. Then you'll have more active members of the community. So the more you own, typically the more active you'll be in the community. So these communities already run, by the way. So if you look at Dash is the seventh largest cryptocurrency and it really focuses to be a peer-to-peer currency. Everything there is run by a decentralized organization, a DAO. So I was talking to a guy the other day. This guy is the head of strategy for Dash. And he now works for a decentralized autonomous organization. He is paid by a DAO. He is paid in Dash currency. And this guy isn't an idiot. Like, he ran a department at Bridgewater Associates, the Bridgewater Associates. Before that, he was at DARPA, the Defense, Advanced Research.
Yeah, we've done shows on DARPA, yeah.
So he's not an idiot, but he's a guy who's saying, look, this is a totally new form of, it's a new form of the enterprise. And it completely cuts out the middleman.
And it also cuts out the leader. You know, the traditional model is there's got to be a leader. There's this old saying, there's a couple different old sayings, like one of them is too many chiefs, not enough Indians, right? And maybe that applies to this, or maybe it's just like decision by committee, look how inefficient government is, or how efficient even charitable boards are and things. I mean, I think they're inefficient at least, you got to have, take for example, and this is what, way before he was president or talking about being president, Trump, right? What Trump used to say in the old days is he used to say, I can make so much more money than all these other real estate investors because I can move fast. I don't have to go take a thing to a committee. If I want to buy a building and, do a development project or whatever, I can just do it. He doesn't have to horse around with a lot of layers of bureaucracy. And that concept, does it come into play here, those concepts I just mentioned, or is this just such a new way of thinking about things and organizations that just different?
That's a great point. I mean, this is still super early on. It is, we're still figuring out what the optimum forms of decentralized governance are. So nobody has the perfect solution or answer to this yet. You're absolutely right. And for the real micro stuff, you're absolutely right. Do you have to bring it to a committee? But for the most part, I look at the way Dash sets things up. Dash has kind of a second layer of what you would call master nodes. And these are kind of like miners, but they don't run mining equipment. But they help process transactions. So everything's very fast. So you can run a master node on your server. In order to be one, you have to commit, I think it's 1,000 Dash. Or 100 Dash, I can't remember, but it's $100,000 plus or $200,000 plus equivalent stake. You still own it. You just have to show that you own it and it's tied up. And you also earn some interest. You earn some of that interest that I was talking about on earlier. So you're vested. There are a few thousand master nodes. There is a very simple website where people just put forward their proposals. And you simply vote on them.
Yeah, but what if people don't vote? What if there's not enough participation? I mean, you've got so many people holding these coins that are part of the system, but, what if only three of them vote?
Well, I mean, I can tell you a heck of a lot of people take a very active interest because they are staked. They have an ownership. So, imagine if you own $10,000 worth of Apple stock and you could go to a website and vote on the things that you wanted them to build.
Well, okay, so let's just address that for a moment. At the end of the day, I think most investors, they don't have time to deal with all this stuff. They just want to invest their money and make a return. Like, that's why they let Tim Cook manage Apple. They don't want to be involved in all this stuff.
I completely agree. But the point is, you don't have to be. Like, you can choose. Like, the point is, what you're looking for is you're looking for a DAO or a decentralized organization that has enough vested interest. Because all of these different DAOs, they're like tribes almost, right? They operate, and you talk about leaders, there are leaders. They may not have executive authority, but people, over time, you get highly visible, credible people in the community. So when so-and-so proposes this, hey, he's been involved in Dash for 2 years, or he's been involved in this project for 2 years. He's always delivered. We should listen to what he says, and we give him more weight. So that's the kind of the way leadership there works. But going back to your other question, it doesn't mean you vote. It doesn't mean, like, if I own $1,000 of Dash, that I'm going to be spending all day, every day, invested in what exactly is happening. What I need to know is there a community that is functioning in a way that the incentives are all aligned, that I can actually be very happy to see an organization. I'm happy to say, in the same way that I'm happy for Tim Cook and Johnny Ive to take care of the Apple thing. I really am. And in the same way, am I happy for this decentralized organization to make sure that my interests are taken into account? So that's the way we look at it. And, this is, when we're going into decentralized governance and decentralized autonomous organizations, this is really, it's the kind of cutting edge, because it really goes down to what is the firm? What is the enterprise? How do we even go about doing commerce and building enterprise and aligning incentives?
Okay, so I agree. I mean, it's interesting, but, you know, this isn't like a clear investment. It may be the way the future works. I mean, I would love to see a much more participatory government, you know, where instead of having these representatives that sell out and become crooks and, you know, special interests, you know, and so forth. I mean, all the problems that we have, it'd be nice to be able to just directly vote on more things, you know, rather than a president every 4 years or a congressman, you know, in between that time or whatever, right? You know, but what does that do for me today as an investor? You know, I don't know.
As an investor today, in the same way that, look, back in the 90s, it was very difficult to, you know, actively say, okay, well, you know, .com means I can now buy all of these things on Amazon and I can join Facebook and so on and so forth. It didn't come immediately, right? And in some of, when you look at a lot of the money that is coming into this space, it is a lot of cart before the horse that's going on. You know, there is a level of mania to this.
No,
for sure.
Hey, I'm glad you admit it, because when I talk to some of my Bitcoin friends, you can't even talk to them. It's like they joined a cult. I mean, they're just, you know, brainwashed. It's crazy how manias work. And, you know, I've read the books on it. And hey, your own Bill Bonner with Agora, you know, he wrote a book on manias, mobs, manias, and whatever it's called. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. But, you know, it's amazing how this groupthink works in human psyche. It's a little scary.
Yeah, it is. And this is kind of why I say, look, the reason I advocate getting involved in this, and, you know, not with a huge amount of capital. You don't need to have a huge amount of capital, right? I mean, we only launched two months ago. I mean, one of our recommendations, I'm just looking up now, we recommended it 50 cents. It's now at $8.29. So, you know, when you see things like that, you know, with a small amount of capital, you can still do okay.
Right, of course, but it could go the other way too, and, you know.
But yeah. Backing up the truck, and yeah. I'm, you know, my responsibility here is I'm not a cheerleader.
Right.
I absolutely believe in the future potential of this space, and I absolutely believe that if you get involved, you will find it fascinating and potentially very profitable. But yeah. At the same time, backing up the truck, no, and I'm certainly not a hardcore cheerleader. I'm, you know, I still come from an investing background. I'm a realist, and, you know, when markets move like this, you know, you have to kind of hold up your hands sometimes and just say, okay,
it's crazy, yeah, right.
That's the market. I've got people keep telling me, you know, Bitcoin is a store of value. I'm like, Bitcoin has been around 8 years. It takes a generation, at least.
Well,
and
the gold bugs will say, you know, it's been a store of value for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
And the dollar bugs will say it's been a store of value for, you know, 230 years, maybe, right?
So real estate, yeah. You know, I don't, you know, Bitcoin, it might be a store of value.
Yeah.
It might be.
Right.
And I'm happy to say it might be. But for people to say, oh, it is a store of value,
I know.
Definitely.
It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, guys. You know, it's at least a generation.
Totally agree. Okay, well, go ahead, and I want to ask you kind of a closing question here that's a fairly big one, but finish up your thought.
I'm going to say I probably sound really bearish, but that's, you know, I certainly don't mean to be. You're like, I'm long this space. I tell everyone, just have a little bit. Get involved. Learn about the space. And because it is, you know, I don't know where we are in this cycle at the moment. So I do strongly advocate people don't just go, oh, it's a scam, and keep it to the sidelines, because you'll close your mind, and that's really what you shouldn't do. You need to be doing the opposite. So just in case I do come off sounding a bit bearish.
Duly noted. Okay, so it wouldn't be fair to talk about this subject, Tama, without talking about the government and central banking cartel, okay, which is, I believe, the most powerful entities the human race has ever known, the government and central banking cartel. And I don't just mean the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government, I mean all governments and all central banks around the world. Now, their product, if you will, their widget, the thing they sell, maybe exclusively, maybe it's their only product, is their respective currency. Whether it be the dollar, the yen, you know, whatever it is, right? The euro, that's their product. And hey, just like anybody in any business with any product, who wants competition, right? Everybody wants to have an open market with no competitor. I mean, you could argue that this is why in the United States we have legal tender laws saying that you must accept the dollar for all debts, public and private. Says it right on the Federal Reserve note, okay? I mean, do you think they're going to let all this go on? Will they squash it? Can they squash it?
It kind of reminds me of that, and I don't know who it was attributed to, but, you know, that give me control of a nation's money and I care not who makes its laws.
Right. I don't remember either, but that's a great quote, and I have repeated it many times, yes.
So, look, banks, this is happening on so many fronts at the moment. Money is just one of them. The threats to the existing status quo are, you know, money is for sure the biggest one, but it's also the whole concept of equity and ownership, right? Because once you have, you know, imagine this, right? Let's say you can buy, you know, that lottery coin. It pays you a profit share. It pays you a dividend. It's not headquartered in any country in the world. It's just decentralized. And let's say you can buy that on a decentralized exchange. Again, an exchange that's not regulated anywhere. You can participate effectively in equity with no regulatory oversight whatsoever. So you can disintermediate the entire SEC, FINRA, everything, potentially. So, you know, that's a pretty substantial shift, right? And I just gave a very simple example of lottery coin, because believe me, there are far, far bigger and more specific use cases. But money, you're absolutely right. At the moment, I think central bankers are probably looking at this and saying, look at Bitcoin. Transactionally, it's not a threat at the moment because, you know, as we discussed earlier, if it costs you $25 on average to conduct a transaction, then it's never going to be used as a peer-to-peer form of cash.
Right. That's higher in many cases than credit card fees.
If you divide
that Bitcoin up into 1/16 parts, depending on what the price is that day, it could be a lot cheaper to just use a credit card. And everybody complains about those transaction costs. So
the bigger threat will come from something like Bitcoin Cash.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin Cash is a fork of Bitcoin, but I mean, it is, you know, it's fast. It's a few cents for fees. And that, you know, you look at currencies like that, and then you've really got the potential to disintermediate cash.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing, you know, Jamie Dimon said, oh, you know, the government will shut it down. Like, well, it can't be shut down. That's the thing.
Well, I don't know if Jamie Dimon is wrong, but go ahead. Yeah.
You can regulate it for sure, but I don't see how you can shut it down. You can make it very, very difficult for merchants, for example, to accept digital currency, for example. You know, maybe there's an additional levy tax. I don't know. I mean, who knows what governments will do? But at the end of the day, you know, if fiat currencies end up being disintermediated, and that is a big, big, big if. Anyone who assumes that's simply going to happen, I think, is out of their mind. Because, as I say, when you lose control of a nation's money, then everything else is lost anyway. I don't know. My suspicion is 2018, we're going to see a huge wave of regulation in the space, especially.
Yeah, I agree.
ICOs.
It's coming. Yeah.
It's, you know, and it's frankly, it's overdue. You know what? The 95% of ICOs are garbage. They really are. They're just riding the back of an underlying technology that's really, really promising.
Well, they're riding a mania. And so they're just taking, you know, it's just, yeah, like you said, it's just junk. Yeah.
They're just adding a .com to their name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we saw that in 1999, everywhere you looked, right? You know, you put .com on your name and every stupid idea in the world suddenly becomes attractive to investors.
There's a small cap company, you know, and it's been listed in the UK, in London, London Stock Exchange since 95. And they recently, even though they said they were getting involved in crypto and blockchain and what have you, the day they rechanged their name and added blockchain to the end of it, the day their stock went up 300%.
Oh my God. This is so illogical and absurd. We're living in an absurd era.
You know, there is some really incredible, amazing stuff that's happening, but a lot of it is being drowned out by the garbage.
Let the buyer beware. But I just want to take you up on that point you mentioned about, you know, can the government squash it, make it illegal? You say they can regulate it, but they can't do that. And I've heard that argument a bazillion times from very intelligent people who say, Jason, it's decentralized. You can't regulate it. It's borderless. I don't know about that. They can just make it illegal, right? If they say it's illegal, and I always use the example of cocaine, right? Because cocaine, and I'm disgusted by cocaine. I'm no fan, okay? But I'm just saying it's an example, right? I saw the Scarface movie years ago, okay? And, you know, that's small, portable, and illegal, and very dangerous drug, right? And not many people trade in it. There are a few people that trade in it, sure, but when you make something illegal and you make people risk their freedom or their life by using it, very few people are going to do it. Some will. There will be the outliers always, but they can just say by fiat, hey, it's illegal. Boom.
I look at the US, right? They're kind of the main, like, if some tin pot country makes it illegal, then so be it. But yeah. I mean, you look at, you know.
So a few already have. I mean, it is illegal in a few countries now. Yeah.
When I come, you know, when I look at the US really still, for all its faults, as kind of the standard bearer for the regulatory side of things. Like, I think it's very, very difficult for Congress to say, hey, guys, Bitcoin's now illegal.
Well, if there's a crisis, either engineered by them or just they take advantage, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. And it'll all be under the guise of consumer protection. They got to watch out for us, little people.
My second thing I was going to say is, if I really wanted to destroy Bitcoin, the way I would do it would be to reverse engineer something that said, you know, I'd want terrorists to use it, frankly.
Right. And they
do. The problem is with Bitcoin is it's completely transparent and you can trace every Bitcoin.
I know people say it's private. It's not private at all. You just look back on the blockchain, you can find everybody.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, they might use another crypto. They might use something else.
Well, they can just say all cryptos are illegal, except the one they make. The blockchain-oriented currency put out by the Federal Reserve 5 years or 10 years from now, that'll be the legal one, you know, the one you have to use for all debts, and private.
I mean, look, if you want to go kind of proper 1984, you start to think about, okay, what if China takes the renminbi and makes it and basically tokenizes it, makes it blockchain based, and then links it to identity. So if I want my benefits, I need to have verified identity. I need to be on the blockchain.
Yep.
Every single banking transaction, everything is all linked to identity.
Yeah, they can really control people. We lose a lot of privacy. That would be terrible. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you know, they're already doing this with the whole social credit score thing. You should look up on that. It's called the social credit system. And it's basically this huge system that says, okay, every individual has like a score associated with them. And it's kind of like a credit score, but it goes well beyond that. It goes to things like, have you bought anything maybe you shouldn't have bought? Have you said anything you shouldn't have said online? Have you, you know, have you been traveling to the Xinjiang region recently or multiple times where there's a big separatist movement? It creates a score. Like, how much of a dissenter potentially to the party line are you? How much of a threat to stability are you?
It's like clout, you know, but for evil, oppressive governments.
Yeah, pretty much something like that.
It's like your clout score with a clout with a K, which is a website that it has a social media score on people. Yeah.
So I'll check that out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how developed governments are going to kick back on this. And bear in mind, some governments are actually quite supportive of the whole industry as well. You know, Singapore, for example, Japan has already legalized it as Bitcoin as tender back in April. Mm-hmm. So it's going to vary. And you know, to be quite honest, there does need to be a big bloodletting at some stage. And we're going to see that next year. And, you know, look, I'll be perfectly blunt with you. There are tokens out there which trade for hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars, which are worth nothing. They're worth zero. They really are. And, you know, there needs to be a bloodletting that shakes those out.
Yeah.
You know, BitConnect, for example, that's just one. If you feel like if anyone's listening to this, just do not buy BitConnect. I'm not going to tell you what to buy, but I'll tell you what not to buy. And that one is called BitConnect.
Okay. Why? Because it's just worthless and it's trading for way too much.
I can't legally call it a Ponzi scheme, but I can call it a Ponzi-like scheme.
Okay.
Or a pyramid-like scheme. Mm-hmm. Just to be aware of that, because yeah, that would be one. But yeah.
Very interesting. Well, as always, let the buyer beware and be careful out there, folks, because I think that Tama presented a very balanced view of this, and I really appreciate that. So thank you. You know, you could have come on this show as a newsletter writer who writes a high-end cryptocurrency newsletter, and you could have said, oh, it's the greatest thing in the world, rah, rah, rah. But, you know, you had a very balanced view. So I really appreciate that. It was very good talking to you, and I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did as well. So so thanks for joining us. And do you want to give out a website?
Yeah, sure. We go to just stansburychurchhouse.com, and you'll see our phone numbers and stuff there. I mean, yeah, as I say, look, I mean, you know, I do write a newsletter, and you know, my subscribers are doing very, very well, in spite of me being obviously maybe a bit too much of a realist.
Right. Who knows? Only time will tell. Maybe you were too little of a realist. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, it's been great, Jason. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for joining us, and happy investing.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.